Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. It's Monday morning. That means it's the Monday morning movie reviews are just about to start here. Eric Childress and Colin Suter join me every week to review all the new movies, and that's what we're going to do here in just a second. And it's also Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We're going to talk about weird food. What's the weirdest food you've ever eaten? And other things like that. Eric is going to stick around after the regular Monday morning movie reviews and give us the final summation and the wrap-up of what he saw at the South by Southwest Film Festival. We'll also do box office. All of that's coming up right here on WGN. You can text or talk to us at 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. You can also check us out on Twitter at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. All right. It is time for the Monday morning movie reviews, and let's welcome Eric to the show. Eric, welcome.
Thank you.
And Colin. Colin, welcome.
Hello there.
All right. So, Eric, in a little bit, we'll talk a little bit more about South by Southwest.
Mm-hmm.
How many movies did you see total?
In town, I saw 22.
Jeez. All right. And we will talk about the ones that we have not spoken of yet.
Okay.
So that'll be coming up. We got box office, too. Boy, that Black Panther. Unbelievable. Really unbelievable.
Yeah.
So we'll talk more about that as well. All right. Well, let's get into the movies. Colin, why don't you start us off with Love, Simon, which Eric and I did not see.
All right. Well, this is a teen drama based on a YA novel, and it stars Nick Robinson as Simon, a typical teenager, or so he tells us, with typical friends and a likable family. But he has one big secret, and that's the fact that he's gay. And one day, someone posts on a somebody at his high school posts on a social media school message board thing anonymously that they're gay and nobody knows it, and he signs his name Blue. So Simon writes back to this Blue person and says, I am also gay and nobody knows it, and the two start a nice little pen pal friendship, but both of them are scared to reveal their identities to one another. Long story short, an annoying character named Martin, played by Logan Miller, finds these emails and uses them to blackmail Simon into setting him up with a girl he has a crush on, and high school complications ensue. Josh Duhamel and Jennifer Garner play Simon's parents, and Tony Hale plays the school principal who tries a little too hard to be down with the kids and what they're into. And at times, it feels like Love, Simon was written by that character. And it's one of the things that kept me from liking the movie more than I wanted to. And I really wanted to like this movie. Because I think obviously it's an interesting story, and it's one I think teenagers should see. But often it tries a little too hard to, sort of be down with the kids and what the kids are doing. And the movie just kind of needs to calm down and pull back on that a little bit. It kind of needs a more delicate hand at the head of this thing. And this movie is directed by Greg Berlanti, who hasn't done a whole lot, but the last movie he did was Life as We Know It, that horrible Katherine Heigl movie. I could just say Katherine Heigl movie, and you guys know it's horrible. And also, which was a movie that has absolutely one of the worst movie posters of all time. You just go on IMDb and you'll know what I mean. Really, of all time. Oh my, I just stare at that movie poster. I'm just like, this exists. This is not a fake poster. This actually happened.
I think that wedding movie with De Niro, what that big wedding?
The
Wedding Party?
Yeah, that's the worst movie poster. That's the worst movie poster I've ever seen in my life.
That's up there.
Yeah, that's way up there. And Greg Berlanti, though,
in the same year.
Was it the same year?
May have been. I don't know. I have to look at that.
Greg Berlanti, though, is like responsible for a lot of TV stuff. Dawson's Creek. He went to Northwestern. He went to school with my ex-girlfriend Helena. I knew him then.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, this is a much better movie than Life as We Know It. I am going somewhere positive with this, so stick with me. It does take a while for it to calm down. There's a little too much superficiality going on in this thing. But once a movie, once the drama kicks in, like the real drama, like the second hour, I would say, it becomes more truthful, more interesting, and I found myself not, wincing as much it just felt like more of a movie to me than just like, hey, here's what kids are into these days, adults. I like more the performances more as it goes on. I really like Josh Duhamel and Jennifer Garner as the parents. I think they're both terrific. And Tony Hale is kind of funny at times. And I do like this. I do like the move where the movie ended up at the end. I would like to see what somebody like Stephen Chbosky could have done with this. But I guess I have to wait another 5 years for him to make another movie. the audience I saw it with loved it. It was a full house, too. It was a very packed crowd. Believe it or not, based on the box office numbers, this movie did actually find its audience. At least in Evanston it did. I'm giving the movie a mild recommendation, particularly to teenagers. Though this is one of those movies where I'm not curious about what my colleagues think of it. I'm more interested in what teenagers think of it, and I'd be curious to see like, is this movie authentic? Does it get it right? Is this really the high school that or is there a lot of wishful thinking going on in the storyline? Because it kind of feels that way at times. But for, a teen drama, in recent years, you could do a lot worse. I mean, this Nick Robinson was in a movie called Everything Everything last year, and that was awful. This is not awful, though. This is okay.
All right. Okay, that's Love, Simon, which is out right now. Okay. All right, Eric, why don't you tell us about The Death of Stalin?
Okay. Well, this is a movie, as the title suggests, about the death of Joseph Stalin, except seen through the eyes of Armando Iannucci, who is responsible for HBO's Veep and The Thick of It, which became the really fantastic film called In the Loop from several years ago. So this is a bawdy satiric take on what happened in the days after Joseph Stalin was found dead in his bedroom. So we have real life historical figures in the film, including Nikita Khrushchev, played by Steve Buscemi, which just that always brings a smile to my face.
Oh yeah, every
time I hear it.
Yeah,
Beria, the chief counsel who was really in charge of trying to get not just the cover up in place regarding exactly how he died, but also sort of wielding his own lust for power and trying to be the puppet master to control everything that was going to happen in the Soviet Union at that time. So you have all of these. These real life figures, including the deputy secretary played by Jeffrey Tambor, Georgi Malenkov, basically used as a puppet for various schemes, and all of them trying to fashion their way into power and just backstabbing one another, creating political intrigue, and also trying to ward off the potential power grab by Stalin's son and daughter, who have really interesting parallels to the current president's children, if you will, as portrayed in the film. But the thing is that this film is playing upon all different types of satire and screwball, and even the casting of Michael Palin just brings about all kinds of references in your own mind to the works of Monty Python.
Hang on, Eric.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take a break, and we'll find out a little bit more about the death of Stalin when we take a quick break here. We got the news coming up, and then afterwards we'll find out what Eric thought of the death of Stalin and what I thought of it and what Colin thought of it as well. So that's all coming up. Stay tuned, and the news is coming up next here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. We're here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. The great Steve Cochran at 6 with your morning drive. This is WGN, and you can check us out. Call or text 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. Good jokey time. We have a Blackhawks Express that we're going to play back. And it's the Monday morning movie reviews, which is what we're doing right now. 312-981-7200. And let's get back to the Monday morning movie reviews. Before the news, before we broke for the news, Eric was telling us about the death of Stalin, and he will continue to do so. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, Eric, continue. Death of Stalin.
Okay. Well, as you can tell there before the break, trying to describe the plot of this movie is enough to get anyone pretty much tongue-tied, because there's so many moving parts and there's so many characters involved that at times you almost feel like you have to be some sort of historian to really sort of keep everything straight in your head. But you don't necessarily need to be, because you are in the hands of a master satirist like Iannucci. And if you're familiar with as many moving parts as there are, even on something as, on a week, an episodic weekly basis like Veep, you can go back and watch and see In the Loop, and see, you know, the different countries and continents and, you know, all the different moving players within the different governments involved, all with their own agendas and eccentricities, all playing at work and all trying to outthink or outdumb one another. You really get a sense of exactly how the death of Stalin plays out, and it plays out beautifully. This is a hysterical film, and I mean, don't let the casting throw you in any which way. I mean, the fact that you have people like Buscemi and Tambor, and the guy that plays Stalin's son, killed me every time. Is sort of this drunken idiot lout who just likes watching hockey. a hockey game that I couldn't help but think of you, Nick.
Yeah, yeah.
The first time I saw it, because that scene is hysterical. But using real life events and, you know, cramming them into this 2-hour power play of a satire, that you almost feel like a historian by the end of it. And you go back and you read up on some of this, some of this material, and you're just like, wow, this guy kind of knows what he's talking about, and really playing up the absurdities of government and not shying away from, like, horrific things that happen, during this period, particularly in the efforts of this Brea guy, who is a class A villain. It's a very timely film, obviously, as well, given everything that's going on right now with us. You can draw parallels to whether our current administration or how you think things might be going on over there currently. We just had a Russian election this weekend. No surprise who won. But this movie has a much lighter touch to it, and it really is guaranteed to be one of the funniest films you're going to see this year.
Yeah. Okay. Colin?
Well, it's the funniest film I've seen so far this year, but I haven't been to Sundance or South By, so my perception's a little more limited than Eric's. But no, this is by far, I mean, it's the best film I've seen so far this year. I know it's only March, but it is exactly, Iannucci's, like, his style of comedy is right up my alley, and the kind of comedy we don't see enough of. Just these, I mean, I saw this movie twice, and I picked up on lines that I missed the first time, which is what I love, which is the kind of comedy that I love. It's just, every characters who just do these quick asides, and you miss them, you blink and you miss them, or a reaction shot that is just brings the whole scene home. There's a scene involving a struggle for a gun, and it just watching the characters surrounding that is just filled me with joy. It's so fun to watch. I also love that this is a movie that is not really about authenticity at all. You know, you get casting, you know, Steve Buscemi and Michael Palin and Jeffrey Tambor. Nobody's trying to copy a Russian accent or, you know, trying to get the dialect right. Steve Buscemi is Steve Buscemi, yeah, and Michael Palin is Michael Palin, and that's that. And I love that. I love that choice. There's so many funny moments in this movie, and the speed and the energy of it, and just like all of Iannucci's work, is breathtaking to watch. This is one of those movies I can't wait to see again, and I wish more people would have turned out for it. But this is definitely the best time I've had at the movies all year so far.
Yeah, it's great. It is. It's just great. I'm a huge fan of this guy's work, and it's very distinctive. Nobody really writes and directs the way that this guy does. You know what I mean? He's got a very, very distinctive style. Like, he's one of those filmmakers that you immediately know his, like, with one scene you can tell that this guy is it's this guy's voice. The casting is hilarious. I remember, Eric, you told me, where did you see this movie the first time?
Toronto.
I remember, yeah, you telling me about this when you said it was a movie called The Death of Stalin, and then you told me who was in. I was like, what? What? But it's genius, and it's really, really funny. All this guy's work. If you're familiar with Veep, you know, it's got that same sort of style that Veep has, and it's with a lot of characters and a lot of, I mean, there's just, and the dialogue is just stinging, you know, and it's just, it's an unusual, it's a weird movie, but it's really, really, really funny and very entertaining. And, I don't see a big crowd going to see this movie. I wish they would, and I hope they would. It's just an unusual film. It's a strange movie, but it's very entertaining and really, really funny. Like, really funny. So,
I mean, I really do hope in time, like, people will see, you know, talk about this movie in the same breath they talk about, you know, The Great Dictator or Dr. Strangelove. I mean, it's that good. Like,
yeah,
people should go really embrace this one.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's a great movie, and it's really funny and really smart, and yeah, it's great. So you should see it. The Death of Stalin, and it's only playing in a few theaters, but you should seek it out. Okay. All right. Let's see. Colin, why don't you tell us about Tomb Raider?
All right. Well, this is the third Tomb Raider movie, but this is a reboot of the popular video game that had a brief movie franchise in the previous decade with Angelina Jolie in the title role. Well, here, Lara Croft, the Tomb Raider, is played by Alicia Vikander. So the story is that she is living in London as a delivery person who practices MMA on the side. And her father, an actual Tomb Raider, has been missing for several years. And when she shows up to collect an inheritance, she's handed an old Japanese puzzle that has a clue as to her father's potential whereabouts. And the clue leads her to a remote island off the coast of Japan. And she finds a boat captain whose father knew Lara Croft's father. And they head to the island and adventure ensues. Dominic West plays her father. Walton Goggins plays the villain here. And Daniel Wu plays the boat captain that she meets. And Kristen Scott Thomas plays Lara Croft's, is it her stepmom, or is it just a woman handling
I think it was her aunt?
Yes, it's her father's sister.
Sister, okay.
Okay.
Right. That wasn't made very clear, though.
Yeah. Okay, all right. So, Tomb Raider, Lara Croft, I got nothing for this. You know, going into this thing, like, I saw the first half of the first film at a drive-in, and we drove out after that first half. We're just like, why are we here? What are we doing here? We already saw one terrible movie. Let's go.
What was the other movie?
I think it was The Patriot.
Yeah.
That's not a good night.
Boy, that's a drive-in movie right there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we left. And that's my experience with Tomb Raider. So I'm going into this thing cold, and at the very least, I'm hoping that Alicia Vikander can make this thing, you know, halfway decent, or maybe the director can. It's directed by Roar Uthang, I can't pronounce his name, who made a pretty what is kind of a generic disaster movie called The Wave a couple of years ago, except that it's French, so that makes it not so generic, I guess. But it was, I kind of like that idea of a French disaster, American disaster movie. But this movie is a generic action movie, really. There's a lot of just kind of, you know, not badly made necessarily, but just sort of bland action scenes or adventure scenes that we've seen before, and it kind of plays out kind of predictably. But Vikander does make for a more interesting Tomb Raider than Jolie did. And it reminded me a little bit of Bruce Willis's performance in the first Die Hard movie, where we're not watching somebody who's coming into this thing all confident and knows exactly what to do in every scene and, you know, knows that every plan is going to work because they've been doing this a long time. No, Vikander kind of comes off as somebody who's learning on the job, you know, while the cameras are rolling. There's a little bit of hesitancy in what she does in about the first half of the movie or so. Like, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know if this is going to work or not, but I'm going to give it a try, and or I'm not going to try because it looks too dangerous. You know, and I kind of like that sort of down-to-earth approach to something like this that could have easily just been a very, you know, otherwise a pretty boring, bland character. Unfortunately, you know, everything around her isn't as interesting, and the movie really just kind of puts her in the back seat for the second half. I mean, it just kind of forgets about, like, her as a character in the second half and becomes a little more plot-heavy, and the plot, it just isn't that interesting. So, I'm not recommending this movie. Overall, it's just not that good or interesting, but I like Vikander in the role, and maybe if they try to do this again, I doubt they will, but if they do...
Well, they set it up. They set it up for a sequel.
Yeah, I know they set it up.
Yeah.
But, you know, is the box office going to be worth it to do another one? I don't know. But, you know, hopefully they get a better writer and a more interesting director at the helm, and maybe we'll see a good Lara Croft Tomb Raider movie someday, because we got a good actor for it.
So. Okay. All right. Eric, hang on, and Colin, hang on, and when we come back, we'll find out what Eric thought of Tomb Raider, and then I'll tell you what I thought of Tomb Raider as well, as we continue with the Monday morning movie reviews. Eric is also going to give us more of his reviews from the South by Southwest Film Festival. So that's all coming up as well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll be back right after this on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower, here till 5 a.m. And it's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a jokey time. We have Blackhawks Express to play back from yesterday's unfortunate game. We're talking about the movies. We got the Monday morning movie reviews, and then we'll talk box office, and then Eric's going to stick around and tell us more about some of the movies that he saw in Austin at the South by Southwest Festival. And that's all coming up. We were in the middle of talking about Tomb Raider. Colin gave it kind of a bad review. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, Eric, what did you think of Tomb Raider?
I think I liked it a little less than Colin did. And one of the reasons, there are a lot of reasons for it, but I disagree with him a bit about Vikander, because like him, I was hoping that this was going to be an upgrade from what Angelina Jolie did with it. And not that I necessarily blame Jolie, I just think that the Lara Croft character, as she's been written, is just a very uninteresting, bland character, and an incredibly humorless one as well. And Vikander seems to have personality in this movie when she's not raiding tombs. The early scenes of her in London, there at least seems to be a bit of a spark. I mean, yeah, she's not, you know, carefree. She's living her own life. It's not a great life. But, you know, there seems to be a little something there. Once she, you know, sort of gets into the adventure aspect of it, yeah, Colin is right that they take the approach that she's basically a novice at a lot of this, and I don't know if that necessarily works for the character, because, you know, when she's in danger, she's hanging on from planes over waterfalls and stuff, which is the only sequence in the movie that I think really works in an action context. She's basically scared, but then when she, you know, has to put together clues and stuff, she's absolutely confident and smarter than everyone in the room, even though the writing of the film makes the clues so, not that the clues are so difficult, it makes everyone around her so dumb that the clues seem like they're hard. Like the clue in the that she gets from the will refers to a letter, and you got Derek Jacobi in the room, and he thinks that someone wrote a letter as opposed to an actual letter. Like even I picked up on that clue. But then, for the first hour of the movie, I'm just going, why don't they just put her in a tomb for 45 minutes and let her, be a little bit closer to the game and let her work her way through clues and peril and stuff and, work her way out of there and, maybe even make this somewhat of a silent movie. And sure enough, for the last hour of the movie, they do put her in a tomb with all the other characters. And it was then that I was absolutely struck by just how the screenwriters just completely just seemed to have watched Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade and stole every single bit from the climax of that movie and a bit involving, why she took all her father's clues and brought them basically right into the hands of the bad guys. Not just Vikander suffers from personality issues in the movie, but to have Walton Goggins as the villain and just completely restrain him to the point that he's just reading lines in this monotonous way. This is a really dynamic actor at given the right material, as we've seen on television and in Tarantino's films. And I was so bummed out to see him playing just some generic villain in the film. And by the end of it, I didn't care anything what was going on. I didn't care who solved what, or if she reunited with her father, or if anyone got out of the tomb alive. I don't want a sequel to this. I'm bored with this character. This movie's absolutely humorless. Colin's right. The direction of the movie is completely generic. I kind of hope we're just done with this character.
Yeah, it's not good, but I love Alicia Vikander. I love her, and I think she's great in it. And I had a blast watching her. The only reason that I didn't fall asleep during this movie was because of her. She's so unbelievably cool and I think awesome to watch. I think she's terrific in the movie, and I think she's the best part of the film. And yeah, it's totally generic. And Walton Goggins, who mostly plays villains, they just cast him because he's Walton Goggins. They didn't give him really anything to do. McNulty's in it, and he's just kind of Dominic West McNulty from The Wire. He's in it, and he just plays sort of the generic dad. He does have. There is one part of the movie that I thought was pretty funny, and it was this. When as you said, Eric, Lara Croft just like gives the bad guy, brings everything the bad guy needs, her dad's journal and all this other stuff, just takes it right to it. And I actually thought Dominic West's reaction to that, where he says, "What part of burn all of my notes do you not understand?" I actually thought that was a pretty funny, but the only part of the movie where there was humor was like that.
I was waiting for him to say I should have mailed it to the Marx Brothers.
Well, that cutaway was pretty funny. And outside of that, it is a pretty humorless thing. Nick Frost is in it for a couple of minutes. I don't know why. And, when you have Nick Frost in a movie and he's not funny, there's a problem. Like, if you can't make him funny, you got issues. But I think she carries it, man. I really do. It's just so watchable. And obviously, she's beautiful. And she handles all the action sequences really well. She does a lot of running. There's a lot of running in the movie.
She runs well.
She runs really well, and she jumps from vine to vine really well. She and how many times is she hanging from something in this movie? Like, literally, she's like hanging. You mentioned the plane; she's hanging from like tons of stuff in this movie. Now, I don't remember Last Crusade, Eric. I've only seen it the one time. What did they? Mm-hmm. So they stole stuff from it? I can't remember.
Well, I mentioned the fact that in the movie Indiana Jones brings Sean Connery's dad's diary,
right,
Brain in the Hands of Nazis. It's exactly what Lara Croft does. And then, when they're going through the whole thing, there's one sequence where the floor falls out from underneath them.
Now, was that in Last Crusade as well?
Yeah, basically. He has to spell the name of God. Okay. And if he doesn't, he's going to fall through the floor.
Okay, I don't remember.
Okay,
that,
right? And the blocks even in the floor look exactly the same.
Okay.
There's kind of a leap of faith moment with a bridge.
Okay.
That's similar to The Last Crusade. Yeah, I mean, it's just ridiculous. And then there's, like, saws coming at her and stuff, and it's like, okay.
Yeah. All right. Well, I mean, it is generic. I think the best action sequence in the movie is the one that you mentioned, Eric, with the plane, where she's on the waterfall and in the plane. I think that was the most deftly executed in the movie. But the rest of it is very generic. But I love her. I think she's awesome and absolutely watchable for me. I mean, and I don't know whether I'm recommending the movie, but she's awesome. That's all I'm saying. And and if there's another Lara Croft movie, I'll go see it if she's in it. And even if it's dumb, because she's awesome. So basically I have a crush on her, and that's why I'm who doesn't, by the way. That's why I'm recommending it. I can see, because I really think she's awesome.
Yeah. Okay.
That's all I'm saying. I got a little thing for her, so that's why I'm recommending the movie. I think she's just great. So anyway, all right. Well, there you go. Everybody go see Death of Stalin.
Yeah.
What do we got next week? We got some big stuff next week, right?
Pacific Rim is next week, and there's a lot of stuff next week.
Isle of Dogs.
No, that's next week.
What?
Week after.
It is?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah, but Steven Soderbergh's Unsane.
Oh, yeah. Shot on an iPhone.
Yeah.
Okay.
Shot on an iPhone.
Shot on an iPhone.
Yeah, and Midnight Sun with Bella Thorne, if anyone wants to go see that.
Oh, okay. Well, that's what we got next. I thought now I got to wait another week.
March 28th.
Come on now. I want to see it now. I want it now.
Okay.
Ugh. All right.
You can if you're that hungry for animation, Sherlock Gnomes comes out.
Oh, that's right.
There you go. There. See?
Sherlock Gnomes. Oh, good Lord. All right. Hey, Colin, thank you, man.
For viewing that.
Thank you, Colin.
All righty.
All right, buddy. We'll talk to you next week.
Bye.
All right. There you go. Eric, hang on, okay?
Sure.
Eric's going to hang out. We're going to come back. We'll talk box office, and then he'll give us another look at some of the movies that he saw at the South by Southwest Film Festival. That's all coming up right after the news here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everyone. How are you? Nick DeGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. We're here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5. The great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. Monday morning, that means my dad's going to call in and tell a jokey time. And we've got a Blackhawks Express to play. We're going to talk about weird foods. What's the weirdest food? IKEA is making weird food, and we'll talk a little bit about that. That's all coming up. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. And you can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page, facebook.com/Nick D Show. Okay. We reviewed the new movies, Eric and Colin and myself. And now we're going to jump into the box office, and then Eric's going to tell us a little bit more about some of the stuff he saw in Austin at the South by Southwest Film Festival. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, let's talk about the box office.
Yeah.
Man, Black Panther with $27 million.
Yeah.
$605 million just in America. What's it doing worldwide?
It's over, I didn't see the latest numbers, but it was at $1.1 billion.
Oh my God.
So it was like, it had just passed, Captain America Civil War and Minions on the all-time chart worldwide.
Wow.
So it's now like the 14th highest grossing film in history.
That's amazing.
It's beyond amazing. I mean, for one, this is it seems like a minor stat, but it's the first movie since Avatar to lead the box office for 5 straight weeks.
Wow.
That seems like an odd stat. You would think that might have happened at some point, but that just shows you the ever-changing nature of, the blockbuster every week, that, the turnaround. And so 5 straight weeks, first movie since Avatar, this movie's going to outgross Titanic.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
It really is unbelievable. It's a phenomenon. It's just it's incredible. It really is incredible. Now, next week, does it have any competition?
I don't know if it does. I mean, the only thing on the list that I see is Pacific Rim Uprising, and I don't know if people care enough.
Yeah.
I think that it might be headed in the same, might even a lesser route than Tomb Raider.
Yeah.
Actually.
Yeah.
And I think Pacific Rim, that the Black Panther could be number six.
6 weeks in a row.
Six weeks
in a row at number one.
Yeah.
That's incredible. Tomb Raider, number two, $23.5 million is how did the Angelina Jolie movies do? I mean, obviously, the first one did well enough to get a sequel.
Yeah, the first one did well enough. First one did twice as much as this one did on opening weekend.
Okay.
It did $131 million. And both of those movies were released during the summer.
Yeah.
So he had a little bit of a leg up. I mean, but the second one, you know, didn't even do half as much as the first movie. So it's not like there's, you know, there's a huge drop off. And that's why Paramount said, like, okay, we're not doing a third one. And they're actually both losers too. They both lost money for Paramount, and Warner Brothers is they spent like $94 million the budget on this one. And did fairly well overseas. It made another $84 million overseas. So this one just, you know, probably going to top out somewhere between $55 and $65 million, somewhere in there. So it's going to need, it's about, you know, you factor that in, it's about halfway home to breaking even. But I don't see Warner Brothers being too happy with that number to go ahead with a sequel on
that. Yeah. But they do set it up, though. I mean, completely at the end.
Yeah.
They set it up for a sequel. Yeah. All right. So $23.5 million, not very good for Tomb Raider. Number three, what's going on here? I can only imagine $17 million. What do we got here?
Nobody saw this coming. Mm-hmm. This is a faith-based film. A faith-based film based around the writing of a Christian rock song.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Dennis Quaid's in it, right?
Dennis Quaid's in it, yeah. A Christian rock song that, I mean, I listened to the song, and, okay. I don't know how you can make a movie based on the writing of this song, because there's really, all the lyrics are just like, what would I do if I met Jesus, and I met Jesus, and then what if I met Jesus again? You know, that was like, if I was smart enough, I could have written that song. So I don't know how you get a whole movie out of it, but Roadside, you know, went wider with this release than they've gone with any film in their history on opening weekend, which is still only 1,600 screens, and they wound up with $17 million.
Wow.
This week. In one weekend, it's the third highest grossing film in Roadside Attractions history.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, that kind of came out of nowhere.
Yeah, it really did.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't even know what it was when I heard the
news. I saw posters of it a couple of weeks ago at my local theater. I didn't even know when it was coming out. They didn't screen it for critics, obviously, because they don't do that with these faith-based movies.
Right.
It didn't matter.
Oh, well, people came out and they saw it. $17
million. People like that song.
Wow, okay. Number four, A Wrinkle in Time, $16.5 million, $61 million total. What are we looking at here? How much did they spend on this movie?
About $100 million.
Yeah,
we're in the $100 million category for this. It hasn't opened very wide overseas yet, so there's not a lot to report there. So, and until that happens, you know, Disney's, you know, can't be too thrilled with this. But, and, you know, it's Disney. I'm sure they can write this one off, and they'll be fine once the next, you know, once Infinity War opens,
right.
And they got that Black Panther money rolling in.
Yeah, so. Black Panther, they're fine. They're happy.
Right.
Number five, Love, Simon, with $11.5 million, that's not bad, right?
It's not bad. Yeah, it's not bad. You know, a film that, you know, clearly based on the teens specialty release with, having a gay themes, and it's being championed, quite a bit. A lot of people, liked it a lot more than Colin did. And it found the audience it wanted to this weekend, I think. I think that's a pretty fair number. It's cost $17 million, so we'll see if this thing ends up turning a profit. But, you know, I think, you know, this is one of those movies that people will be fine if it doesn't, you know, make huge box office, because the fact that it exists is kind of a victory.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard, you know, like, just following on social media, people really like this movie. People are really, really liking it. And I'm glad it's doing well. That's cool.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to check it out. I'm going to see it at some point. Number six, Game Night, $5.5 million, $54 million total. Is that, that's okay?
It's doing okay. Yeah, I mean, Warner Brothers is in this kind of this funk right now. I mentioned it with Tomb Raider. The only hit that they've had since It came out, was a huge hit last fall, has been Paddington 2.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else has been a loser for them. Game Night's on the small end loser right now. It still needs about another 22, 35, maybe $35 million, I think it was, before it turns a profit. It's done okay overseas. I think it was about a $35 million budgeted film, so it still needs a bit, but it's, you know, it's got kind of a steady drop going here in the U.S., so that number, I think they'll be fine with that.
Okay. Boy, number seven is a hit. Peter Rabbit, $5.2 million, over $100 million in America.
Yeah, yeah, most definitely. One of the only films this year that's grossed $100 million. I think the only other ones besides Black Panther, the 50 Shades movie, is very close. But yeah, no, I mean, I think that, you know, all the people all the people that were trying to get people to see Paddington 2 all that time are not exactly happy that this is the movie that all the parents took their kids to see.
Right, right.
But you know, hey, you know, good on Sony. They got a $100 million hit on their hands.
Okay. Number eight, Strangers Pray at Night, 4.8 million with 18.6 million total.
Yeah, they seem like they missed the window on this one. This seemed like, you know, the Strangers was a kind of a small little hit back 10 years ago, and waiting 10 years ago, or waiting another 10 years to do a sequel to it seemed like why?
That's exactly what I thought, you know.
Yeah.
When I was like, well, who was waiting for a sequel to The Strangers?
Right.
Especially when Them exists.
Yeah. So. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, Shout Factory put out a new collector's edition to remind people about The Strangers.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen the new one yet. Did you like it?
It's better than the first one.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
It's different because the first one was a slow burn.
Yeah.
You know, this is more like in your face.
Oh, okay.
So actually, no, I'm sorry. The first one's still better, but this one, it's not bad.
Oh, okay.
It's not bad. It's not nearly as bad as one would think.
Okay.
But I still recommend Them.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Number nine, Red Sparrow, 4.4 million. This is not doing well.
No, it's not doing well at all, it's just, I mean, people are, you know, trying to make this a Jennifer Lawrence loss, and I don't think so. I don't think that's on her, really.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, it's a spy thriller with not a lot of action in it, you know, so it's more a little more Jean Le Carré than Atomic Blonde or Bourne.
Well, see, that's what I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be Atomic Blonde.
Right.
And I had to adjust myself
mm-hmm.
while I was watching. And I think it's a good movie. I like it. And
yeah, I do too.
Yeah. And I think she's terrific in it.
Oh, she's great in it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't think that this is exactly what people wanted. And I think on top of it, you know, people were kind of ragging on the kind of the treatment that the character goes through throughout the movie,
even though
kind of essential. It's not, you know, trying to demean her. It's all about her overcoming that kind of behavior, you know, that kind of treatment,
right?
Which is the whole point.
Yep.
But you know, some people, I think, were a little bit turned off by that as well.
All right, and then number 10 is Death Wish, 3.3 million, 29 million, almost 30 million total,
in which everyone was turned off.
Yeah. So there you go. All right, Eric, hang on.
Sure.
Eric's going to hang out with us, and when we come back, we're going to talk more about the movies that he saw at the. He goes to all the film festivals, and he was just at the South by Southwest Fest in Austin, and we're going to find out what he thinks of some more of those movies that are out. And we'll get that coming up right after this. Welcome back, everybody. How are you? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. We're here till 5. We're going to talk about weird food. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. It's Monday morning. We just finished up the movie reviews in the box office, but Eric is sticking around with us because he covers the film festivals for us, and he was just in Austin at the South by Southwest Fest, and we've got more to talk about that. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, where do you want to start?
Well, you know, when we talked last time, we sort of covered a lot of the bigger releases that are going to be coming out, you know, Quiet Place, Ready Player One, things like that.
Right.
So I wanted to talk about a couple of the movies that are likely going to be picked up at some point, smaller indie releases that you'll probably have to look for.
Cool.
Around the corner in certain theaters, but are going to be well worth your time.
All right.
And the first one I want to start with was one of the real complete surprises of the festival. It's a movie called Thunder Road. And it actually ended up winning the jury prize for narrative feature. And it's written, directed, and stars Jim Cummings, whom people probably most likely not familiar with. But he directed a short that the film is an extension of from a few years ago, which I think you can find on YouTube. I think it's under the same name, Thunder Road. And in the movie, he plays a cop whose mom has just passed away. And the opening scene of the movie, which is the short, actually, is him at the funeral giving this long-winded eulogy in one take that doesn't quite go the way he planned. And what you're watching throughout the course of the movie, we see that he has a young child. He's been in a divorce. He's got a partner, kind of an unstable relationship in the police force, and you're watching a character that is trying to keep himself grounded, but you're watching someone who could very easily just fly off into a rage or in really bad behavior at a moment's notice, just based on the well of emotions that he is going through at the current time. I mean, this is a character that at any moment could become Travis Bickle, or you could be watching something that is incredibly sad, or watch something that is absolutely redemptive. And that's a really tricky tone to pull off. You know, the film, for some, might seem a little episodic as it goes from his personal life to work and back again, horrific things happen, and really funny things happen throughout the course of the movie. But when you pull a tone off like that so confidently, it comes off. There's a really rewarding experience waiting for you by the end of this movie. Virtually nothing about this movie going into it, and what we saw was the kind of the emergence of a great new voice in cinema named Jim Cummings.
And it did win. It won the audience award.
It won the grand jury.
It won the grand jury prize. Okay.
Yeah. And it's really a pretty remarkable film.
Okay, that's called Thunder Road, and does it have distribution yet or no?
Not yet. Not yet.
Okay.
We're hoping we might hear an announcement sometime soon.
Okay, cool. All right, so that's Thunder Road, and that's one to look out for. Okay,
mm-hmm.
Where do you want to go next?
I want to go to a film called Relaxer.
Okay.
This is a really odd film, too. The director of the movie, his name is Joel Petroikis, I think is how you pronounce his name.
Mm-hmm.
He's done a couple movies over the last few years that have been at festivals, including one called Buzzard, has the same star of that film, an actor named Joshua Burge. And in this movie, the movie is set right on the verge of Y2K. He plays a character that, as the movie opens, he is basically in his underwear, sitting on his couch, being egged on by his older brother, played by the wonderful David Dismalchin, to finish this challenge, which is basically a stupid guy challenge involving him playing this skateboarding video game while drinking a carton of milk, and never having to get off the couch to go to the bathroom. It's one of these stupid guy things that he has to do. And the whole movie is him ending up sitting on this couch because he is re-challenged to get to the end of Pac-Man, level 256 on Pac-Man. And he can't get off the couch until he does it. And he just spends the whole time trying to figure out how to get food to him, how to get to drink and have sustenance, how to go to the bathroom. He does have visitors, and it is just a weirdo movie that, especially particularly the first half of the movie, had me rolling on the floor with laughter.
Okay.
Rolling on the floor. And it's not a movie that everyone is going to have that same experience to. You have to really sort of get into the absurdity of the humor in the film. It can get disgusting at times, which normally can be a turnoff for me, but it worked for me here. And it goes into weird territory involving the Y2K stuff, and leads to a very crazy, strange ending that, again, people are going to go like, what the hell just happened? And I kind of love it for that. So it's a movie called Relaxer. Dismalchin is really funny,
as the
brother in the film. It's Oscilloscope has it, so you'll have to find it and see if it gets released here in Chicago. But if you hear the title, be sure to check it out.
Okay.
It's called Relaxer.
Relaxer. That sounds pretty great to me.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Eric, hang on, okay?
Okay.
Eric Childress is hanging out with us, and we're getting reviews from the movies that he saw at the South by Southwest Film Festival, and we'll get more coming up right after we take this break. All right, welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And we are live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. This is where we do our Monday morning shows, and then we're downstairs in the Showcase Studio Tuesday through Friday. Monday morning movie reviews, we did that. We did the box office. Eric Childress was covering, who covers the film festivals for us here on the show. Just got back from Austin. He was at the South by Southwest Film Festival, and we're talking about some of the movies that he's seen there, and then we'll have a chance to see them hopefully soon when they get released. And welcome back, Eric.
Thank you.
Okay, man, where do you want to go next?
Let's go to A Vigilante.
Okay.
This one stars Olivia Wilde as a woman who has survived a really horrible, abusive relationship and has gone on and trained herself to become a vigilante. And not in the Death Wish mold, per se, but in the mold where she is able to basically become like a savior, guardian angel for women in other abusive relationships. Basically is almost like a businesswoman who will get them out of the situation they are in, sometimes inflicting harm when necessary, but not necessarily inflicting death. She's actually saving that, if she possibly can, for her own husband, who remains at large and uncaptured due to the horrific things that he had done with her. Olivia Wilde, I think that we're both in agreement how great she was in Drinking Buddies.
Oh, yeah.
Years ago,
yeah.
And this might be even stronger performance.
Wow,
yeah. Obviously, completely different kind of performance. People who might want to look at something like Jennifer Lopez and Enough, something like that. It's not like that at all. There's a lot of internalized expressions of grief and the pain that she's clearly been carrying with her. Her performance says a lot that the screenplay doesn't, and that's always a positive thing. And the first hour of this movie is absolutely terrific, as we sort of episodic go through situation after situation where she helps these other families out. Not just it's a very important distinction, not just husband and wife situations, but also children who are abused as well. Mm. It's a very important sequence that I think helps bridge that divide. Unfortunately, the third act of this movie gets a little too routine, in that it really brings the central relationship between her and her husband to the forefront, and it becomes, at times, a little cartoonish for my taste. It's really kind of a really unfortunate bridge between the first hour, but the first hour is so strong and she is so good throughout the movie that it's still a pretty easy recommendation, and show that Olivia Wilde can be a force to be reckoned with when she's given the right material.
There you go. Okay, A Vigilante. And now, does this have a distribution?
Not yet.
Okay.
Not yet, but I'm sure it will.
Yeah, well, I mean, you got Olivia Wilde as your lead, and mm-hmm. and if she's as good as you say she is, I wouldn't be surprised if it got it.
Right. So. Yeah, some indie distributor will pick this up right. Without question.
Okay, and the woman who wrote and directed it's her first feature.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yes.
Sarah Dager Nixon
right.
is her name. Okay, all right, what's next?
Another one, a crime kind of comedy, in a way, so it's kind of a comedy, called Brother's Nest. It's an Australian film directed and starring Clayton Jacobson and his real-life brother, Shane Jacobson, and they play brothers in the film who are plotting the death of their stepfather. He's apparently, the will has not exactly turned out right for them, and they're going to make sure that they're still in on it before the old man croaks himself. So the first half of the movie is them basically taking us through what they believe is going to be the perfect murder, taking us through step by step exactly how they're going to behave, what they're going to say. All the motions take us through the geography of the farmhouse where they're going to commit this crime, and all, of course, them arguing about exactly if this is the right thing to do or not. And then this back half of the movie is the execution of this crime. And as you might expect, things don't always go as planned as when you try to commit the perfect murder. And this is a really solid film. It's the kind of film that has drawn some comparisons to Blood Simple.
Mm.
Not quite to that level, but there's, again, a real confidence in the storytelling. Again, I like the separation of the two halves, and in what, so when you get to the second half, you know exactly what's going wrong and when it's going wrong, and at least a very satisfying climax. The two brothers, Clayton and Shane Jacobson, are both very good in the film, and I think fans of that kind of that those the Coen crime films and you know any kind of film noir type stories, particularly ones that have a little bit of dark humor to them, are really going to enjoy this one.
Okay. Now you said it's Australian. Has it been released in Australia already?
I don't know if it has been or not. I haven't seen a release date anywhere. Just apparently, I think it might just been the premiere at South by Southwest.
Yeah, I'm looking at the. I just looked it up on IMDb. There is a trailer. Mm-hmm. They do have a trailer for it.
Yeah.
But its release date says March 11th. That's when it was screened at Sundance. So I guess there's no other release for it. But there it is.
Right.
Okay, so that's Brother's Nest.
Mm-hmm.
All right, cool. All right, where to next?
Let's go to Andrew Bihalski has a new movie. And it's called Support the Girls. And it has a really fantastic cast in it. Regina Hall plays the manager of this kind of like a Hooters sports bar. All the girls wear push-up bras and little short shorts and just local hangout, you know, local sports bar. And she's just kind of on her last legs at the place, but she's very much adored by the people that work there, even those that have had to be let go for various reasons. The cast includes also Haley Lou Richardson from Columbus, who I think is she. We were talking about this at South by how she seems to be like she's like one role away from like breaking out into the mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
Haley Lou Richardson is a name that people need to remember. She's you know Columbus. If you haven't seen that from last year,
Edge of 17.
Right.
She's great.
She's even though a really bad movie called The Bronze.
Yeah.
But I went back and just watched her.
She was in that. She's in Split.
Split. Yeah. Correct.
She's good, man.
Right.
She's
a very mainstream movie.
Yeah. She's the deal, man. She's the deal.
She really is, and yep. She's terrific here. She plays kind of like the bubbly personality who's very aware of her surroundings, but just enjoys her work. Dylan Galula is also in the film. It's a really strong cast, and it's just a, you know, slice of life thing. You know, Andrew Bihalski, has done movies in the past where he kind of came out of that mumblecore situation from years ago, and he did a great movie a couple years ago called Results with Colby Smulders and Guy Pearce. And this movie seems to be kind of a bridge between the more confident style that he had in that movie and the kind of the old school, kind of fly by the seat of your pants, or short shorts in this case, mentality where it's just, a lot of characters, just kind of weaving in and out as things go on. But Haley Richardson is terrific in it. Regina Hall is really good in this movie. And it's just, you just want to see a movie about women who have absolutely control of and confidence in their own skin. This is the kind of movie that, is going to be supported a lot, literally, in the coming years.
Okay, cool. So let's Support the Girls.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And let's do one more here, Eric.
One more. Let's see. Which one do we want to do here? Okay, how about a movie called Family?
Family. Okay.
yeah. So this one stars Taylor Schilling as a businesswoman who has basically shunned all possible connections to not just her own family, but having a family of her own. She's single. She has no children. She has worked her way up into the business world and it's kind of take no prisoners. When her brother and his wife have to go off for an ailing family member, she gets tasked with taking care of her niece. It's one of those stories where bad parenting, yeah, comes into play. Doesn't exactly know how to handle this character, but the young girl who is in middle school is picked on, not very well liked, and meets a boy at a convenience store who has a fascination with juggalos.
Oh God!
Needless to say, juggalos play a very big part in this movie. I'm sorry, I'm forgetting his name from Atlanta, the rapper. The actor.
You mean Paperboy?
Yeah, Paperboy.
Brian Tyree Henry.
Tyree.
Yeah.
Yes. He's in this movie. He plays the owner of a karate dojo.
Oh, God.
Yeah, that the niece goes to. He's only not in a whole lot of scenes in this movie, but he kills in this movie. It's a really funny movie. Kate McKinnon plays the next-door neighbor who is not happy when this character just won't, keep her garage door closed or stay on her own property and stuff. There's a lot of really funny bits. It's very vulgar. So if you like that type of humor, obviously we do.
Yeah.
Where people just swear really nasty stuff at one another.
All right.
This is the movie for you. Okay. And it's got juggalos.
Okay, so that's called Family. All right, Eric, hang on, okay?
Okay.
We're going to do one more segment with Eric here, and we're going to come back and get more reviews from some of the movies that he saw at South by Southwest. But right now, though, we got to take a break for weather and traffic, and I got the weather for you right now. All right, welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're going to talk about weird food coming up after the news. IKEA's got some weird stuff happening. And my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. We got a Blackhawks Express from yesterday's game to play as well. And we're talking here with Eric Childress. Eric covers all the big film festivals for us here on the show. And we get previews of movies that we're going to see in the coming weeks and months. So we're talking about some of the stuff that he saw at South by Southwest last week. So let's get back and say hello to Eric. Hey, Eric, welcome back.
Hello.
All right. What's next on the agenda?
It's March Madness. So why don't we do a basketball?
All right.
And the film is called Chi-Town. And it is documentary set here in Chicago, and it follows the yearly sort of rise of a young athlete named Kiefer Sykes, who went to Marshall High School on the West Side. And the movie follows his, basically his dream of, and coming up to the NBA and curtailing that with not just the struggles of his own family. He does also have a young son and lives with his parents. But also, a movie set on, within the city, it details the everyday struggles of the violence that we hear so much about.
Right.
He has friends that have been involved in violence on both ends of the spectrum. He is a coach that falls prey at one point. So the movie kind of goes back and forth between seeing his yearly rise year by year through, particularly through the college ranks, as he becomes a guy that sets all kinds of records in college, playing for Wisconsin and Green Bay. And as you're watching, you're just like, how do we not know more about this kid? Why is he not in the I not heard about him in the NBA? And the movie doesn't have a great cinematic answer for that. But when you hear Chicago basketball documentary, you're going to be drawn back to Hoop Dreams.
Yeah, I mean, that's immediately what you think of.
Right, right. And Hoop Dreams obviously was this epic, journey that Steve James gave us, this three-hour film.
Yeah.
I mean, this film only comes in at about 81 minutes, yet is tracking, what seems to be like a four or five-year journey of this kid. And, I really like the juxtaposition between, him rising, towards the top and having this success, while it just seemed like every time he has some success, something really horrible is happening within the city. And it felt like there could have been a lot more of that explored. It felt like that you had another, this could have been like Hoop Dreams 2, basically. I think that they had a really interesting subject here, and I don't think that it's fully explored to the maximum capacity that it possibly could be. I mean, there are, the city looks great. This kid's a really interesting subject. He's a really nice guy. You want him to succeed, and I wish there was a bit more just depth to it.
Okay.
I wish that I could have rather would have liked to have seen this going on for another 45 minutes at least to sort of explore more and more of his feelings. It's more a little more. Here's all the stuff that's happening, and then he talks a little bit, and then here's more stuff that's happening, and then he talks a little bit. It's one of those types of movies. It's not bad. I think that people, particularly anyone here in Chicago is going to be interested in this story. And I think, you know, it does play into that nature of, you know, what happens to kids who might seem, you know, anonymous athletes, and just how hard it is to get to the NBA.
Mm, okay. All right, and that's called Chi-Town.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there you go. Documentary called Chi-Town. All right, let's hear another one.
This is a prospect. And, you know, it's not all every day that you can get a really interesting kind of world-building science fiction movie on such a shoestring budget. And that's what this movie actually does. It starts off as a movie about, obviously, sometime in the future. There's, like, a young girl, like 13, 14 years old, and her father are basically prospectors. They're aboard a spaceship, and they go down to a planet looking for wealth or, you know, minerals, anything they possibly could find to make their fortune. And they end up going down to one planet, and they run into a couple of other prospectors, and it becomes this clash between the two of them, a clash for survival. Pedro Pascal, people might know from Game of Thrones, been in a few movies, but mostly from Game of Thrones, plays one of the other prospectors, and he's kind of doing Nathan Fillion in Serenity, in Firefly. Basically, he's kind of playing Maul,
okay,
which works pretty well, as far as I was concerned. So there's a real intellect to the dialogue. There's kind of a sense of playfulness, along with the tragedy and the sort of the peril that's going on with them being trapped on this planet together. Kind of an enemy mine, Hell in the Pacific kind of feel to it, and it works. It works. It's a good film.
Mm, okay. The girl who's in it is from Chicago.
Oh, is she?
Yeah, because I'm looking at her credits, and she was in The Exorcist, the TV series, and Chicago Med, and it looks like she's from Chicago.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
okay, so. Yeah, she's really good in the film.
Cool. All right, one more quick one, and then we got to go.
Oh, one more quick one.
Yeah.
How about Friday's Child?
Okay, Friday's Child.
Okay. Again, didn't know much about this one. Seemed to have a plot that we hear a lot at South by Southwest. Young man played by Ty Sheridan from Mud and Ready Player One,
yep,
is released from prison, or he's been like in a halfway house and is getting a chance to be off on his own now. He doesn't, you know, things aren't going well. Doesn't have a lot of money. Doesn't have a great job. Ends up meeting a young woman played by Imogen Poots, and they begin to form a relationship together. But at the same time, while he's trying to stay the straight and narrow, he runs into a bad influence played by, wait for it, Caleb Landry Jones.
Oh, he's a bad influence?
You think so? When you meet Caleb Landry Jones on a bus.
Yeah.
You get off the bus, okay? Yeah, so he meets him, and he's the absolute opposite spectrum of this guy. Every time he shows up in this guy's life, things, you know, tend to go a little wrong, as one would expect, meeting Caleb Landry Jones on a bus.
Right.
And this movie, you know, I was actually... Not just myself being surprised, but people who I was with were surprised how much I like this film, because this movie has a very distinct Terrence Malick feel to it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. There's a bit more. It's not so much a lot of, there's really no narration to it, but there's a lot of really beautiful shots, a lot of things calculated with silence, a lot more dialogue than a Terrence Malick film, but it has that feel to it. So
yeah,
clearly the director has watched a lot of Terrence Malick films and has learned, as far as I'm concerned, some of the better parts from those movies.
Wow.
I think Sheridan and Poots are really good together. Sheridan is really strong in the film, and I liked it.
Okay. All right, so that's Friday's Child. Okay, we'll look forward to that one. All right, well, Eric, overall, you had a good time at the fest.
I did. It was a good fest. We, you know, there were a lot of films, you know, we talked about the big ones last week.
Yeah.
And we didn't think that, we didn't know a lot about a lot of these movies. We had seen a few at Sundance, and, walking into a lot of these things kind of blind.
Yeah.
I think kind of helped elevate the experience a little bit.
Because
the expectations were just kind of there. And we walked into a lot of things and walked out going like, man, that was much better than we would have ever imagined.
Well, that's cool. All right. Yeah. Well, that's cool, man. All right, Eric, we'll talk to you next week with all the new movie reviews.
Sounds good.
All right, buddy. Take care. There you go. Eric Childress exclusively covering the film festivals for us. And we just heard some really interesting films from the South by Southwest Film Festival. All right. We got to take a break. We got the news coming up next on 720 WGN.